If you're a Disney Plus subscriber and you're watching The Mandalorian, Jack and I have a podcast for you.
Every week, we'll discuss the latest episode of The Mandalorian and talk about other great content and maybe some not so great content on Disney Plus as well.
As two lifelong Star Wars fans, we have a ton of fun geeking out over all the little details of the show, and we want you to join us every Monday.
So search for Disney Plus Reviews. That's Disney P-L-U-S Reviews. Hey, Phil, how about that Baby Yoda? Baby Yoda says, what's a podcast?
What else with Corey Mann from the Studio DNA Podcast Network.
I'm so excited to talk to our first guest of 2022, spanning a 35-year career in music. 49 number one songs, over 25 albums, sales in the tens of millions, 5 Grammys, 59 GMA Dove Awards, an America Music Award probably somewhere in the house holding a door open or something. Author, husband, father, grandfather. How many actual kids? How many actual grandkids?
Six and six. Six kids and six grandkids now.
Stephen Curtis Chapman, thank you for being my first guest.
You are so welcome, Corey, man. It is good to be with you, brother.
Oh, I left something out of the resume.
Oh, boy.
The voice of Baloo in the Jungle Book Groove Party video game?
Well, now, little britches. You know what? Here's a... I'm going to give you a scoop. I don't think I've told anyone this. I hope I'm allowed to. I'm gonna tell it whether I'm allowed to or not, and we'll just let the chips fall. You know, several years ago, a good buddy of mine who does character voices for Disney out in the studios in California, big wig at Disney for years and years, he calls me and says, "Hey, we need a new Baloo," and I said, "Dude, I am all over that." I said, "Baloo is my favorite actor of all time," and when I was a kid, I loved Jungle Book. Had the record, had the vinyl disc, you know, that I'd listen to over and over again. Look for those bare necessities. I said, man, I could be Baloo. I can do this. So went in, did a bunch of, you know, audition tapes and all this. And this was for a reboot of the Jungle Book movie. Well, at the 11th hour, John Goodman, I mean, who's John Goodman? Walks in and says, I want to do Baloo. So they give him the part. So, but in the meantime, I ended up, there was a PlayStation video game being made. So they asked me to do the voice of Baloo for that. So I did that. Did a few little things for the Disney Channel, like bumpers and things like that, where I voiced Baloo. So that was 20 years ago. I get a call from my buddy about 6 months ago. Hey, I just came out of a production meeting. They're doing a new live-action kind of CGI movie of the Chippendales Rescue Rangers. And it's Andy Samberg... And it's his whole crew that are doing it. And it's like Seth Rogen is doing a voice, and Andy Samberg is doing one of the voices. A guy named John Mulaney, a comedian, is doing one of the voices. Yeah. It's got a part in there where Baloo, it's like they assemble all of the Disney characters, a bunch of them, to help them like fight off the bad guy or something. And he said it's a really clever kind of deal, and they need a Baloo. And so I submitted your old stuff. He says there's about 20 people in the running for it because they've got a bunch of different people. Calls me back and says, man, do this little audition thing, and because they're kind of intrigued. They kind of like, you know, your thing. So I get the part. I'm voicing Baloo in a new movie. It's coming out with all these guys, you know, doing the voices of Chip and Dale and everything.
That's an iconic character.
Isn't that cool? That is so cool. Oh. I get to sing the Bare Necessities in it. Get to do the whole song. So it's pretty cool. So you have to be watching for your old pal SCC.
I've got goosebumps.
I have to be careful because I told somebody the other day, I said, yeah, I got a part in this new Chippendales movie. And they're like, you're wearing like the bow tie and the cuffs, you know, no shirt. Ben, you've been working out for that? I was like, no, different Chippendales entirely. Come on, get your mind out of the gutter, people.
Look for the bare necessity, the simple bare necessity. Forget about your worries and your strife. I mean the bare necessities, old Mother Nature's recipes that bring the bare necessities of life. Wherever I...
Stephen, tell me about Herb and Judy Chapman. Let's start with parents.
my mom was 16 when she met my dad. My dad was, I think, 19. Got married very, very young. Had my brother very shortly. They were young, and the story that I'm kind of told, and I tell it, I write about it in my book, is my mom and dad were really struggling. Young, you know, didn't know how to be married, and I mean, they were kids, you know, babies having babies, and my dad had grown up without a dad in his life. His dad was an alcoholic and left home when my dad was 3 years old, so he really never knew him. Met him twice, he said, very briefly, where this sort of homeless guy showed up on the playground of his elementary school, and it turned out to be his dad. And he was a great man, very, very smart, was in the Navy, but alcohol just destroyed his life. And he died by the time my dad was, I think, 9 or 10 years old. His father had passed away. So he didn't have a father. My grandmother never remarried, so he never had a real father figure in his life. He had his grandfather and grandmother that lived with him. A lot of turmoil there, a lot of, you know, just shame and all that. So that was sort of the undertow, you know, in my home, I think, going on early on. But good. I mean, my dad's great, great man. Wanted to make it work with my mom. But the story they told me is they were really at a point of almost deciding, maybe we just need to call it quits. This isn't, you know, we've got a baby, but this is just not going well. Or they thought, let's have another kid. I don't know why that seemed like the right thing to do, but apparently that was a thought somewhere in that process that maybe this would, I think my brother kind of surprised them and came, you know, a little sooner than they had thought. And like let's plan this and think this through. And that was me. And so I think my earliest years were a lot of struggles, a lot of still the conflict and all that going on. My dad loved music, started playing music when he was a kid. I had always wanted a little music store, so he opened a guitar shop in Mayfield, Kentucky, in fact. When I was about 6 years old, my dad's dream was to play on the Grand Ole Opry, play country and bluegrass and folk music, and a great, great singer. And he was being pursued by some big-time people to maybe make a career in music. He was chasing that dream. But when I was about 6 years old, he and my mom and brother all really committed their lives to the Lord. Revival came through our little home, our little church in Paducah, Kentucky, and it really changed his life. My mom, we started going to church together, started praying together as a family, and I really clearly remember, you know, when those fights would start, when the conflict would start to bubble, and I'd get afraid. I remember my dad stopping and saying, "Hey, you know what? We need to pray," and we'd join hands and we'd pray, and my dad would just say, "God, help me. You know, help me be a good dad. I don't know how to do that. Help me be a good husband." So I started to see this happen in my home. Within about a year, we're sitting in church together, and I remember the Sunday morning, I remember Brother David, the pastor, preaching and saying, "Jesus says, I stand at the door and knock. If any man opens the door, I will come in." I remember him quoting that scripture, and my heart was pounding, and I thought, he's knocking at my heart. So I went and prayed and was baptized and really began my faith journey with my family, and we started singing together. And so that was the home that I grew up in, a home without faith, really, without, you know, that part of us and experienced that, and then just saw this transformation happen. And we were far from perfect, plenty of mess still, you know, that you know, carry through life with you. But really, really grateful. My memories, you know, so much of them are just of being in church with my family, singing together. We started singing music, learned some Bill Gaither songs, you know, and started singing in church, and started my dad's little music store was cooking along, and I would began to work for him. I went to work when I was just a kid in my dad's music store, started out, you know, dusting off the guitars and cleaning out the showcase, and eventually became a teacher, started teaching guitar lessons for my dad. That was the home I grew up in, and the family, and loved music. My dad laid his dream down to pursue music because he knew it was going to take him away every weekend. He was playing music, and he wanted to be in church with his family. And I'm probably sitting here talking to you today, large part because of that decision my dad made, because he was there, and we were together, and we started singing, playing music. He was teaching me, you know, he'd come home, teach me, you know, "Dad, teach me another song," you know. And the cool thing about the music that my dad, because he owned a music store, because he was a guitar teacher, his students would come in and they'd say, "Hey, I want to learn this song." And it was whatever was playing on the radio. And I can remember my dad coming home and saying, "Hey, check out this song, son. You know, I just teaching this to a student. It's a cool song. And it was Drift Away. Remember the old, give me the beat, boys, to free my soul. I want to get lost.
Oh, give me the beat, boys, to free my soul. I want to get lost in your rock and roll and drift away.
And it had this cool guitar part, and my dad was like, you know, hadn't figured it out, and was showing it to me and showing me these cool guitar lines, you know. And I was exposed to all kind of music, I think. It wasn't just gospel music, Christian music, whatever. And that was when even Christian music was kind of in its, some would say, infancy. You know, I was hearing, I remember Dallas Holm came through my town, and we went and saw him perform the Imperials, you know, and those were the first concerts I ever attended, you know, were those kinds of concerts. I'd never seen a rock and roll show or anything. The first concert I ever attended was Andre Crouch and the Disciples. So, you know, that was my home.
What was Dad's store? What was the name?
Chapman Music. In fact, my dad's store just closed. He moved it from Mayfield, Kentucky, years ago to Paducah. And then just recently, my dad's 82. His eyes are not good, and his health is kind of failing, but he still teaches guitar lessons 5 days a week. He's still in his store every day teaching kids. I called him yesterday, Dad, what are you doing? Well, I got a student sitting here, going to make him a star. You know, it's what he always says, going to make him a big star. But his store, they sold, he was renting, and they sold it, and they were going to go way up on rent and do a bunch of renovations, and he couldn't afford to do it. So he moved to a different place. We had this big sign he's had up for years and years. It says Chapman Music since 1964. I said, Dad, I want that sign. He got him to take it down. I mean, it's huge. It's like 8x8. It's a massive. I don't know what I'm going to do with it, where I'm going to put it, you know. But I'm like, I got to have that sign. Yeah, I've got some cool memorabilia, and his walls were plastered with all kinds of stuff, because album covers of mine, I mean, he's been my, you know, it's kind of like a shrine, you know, to the career of Stephen Curtis, because, you know, he was so proud. And one of the coolest pictures, though, because I told you my dad's dream was to play on the Grand Ole Opry. And he laid all that down. He's like, you know, I want to be with my family. So years and years later, I recorded a bluegrass album. And I called my dad and said, you got to come sing on this record with me. And so he and my brother and I all did this together, did several songs. So the day the record was releasing, I played the Grand Ole Opry. And I brought my dad out. He sang with me. And Ricky Skaggs was on that night. And he came out and played with us. I've got an amazing picture of my dad, my brother, and me. Ricky Skaggs and my son Caleb was there, and he came out and sang one with us too. So you had, you know, three generations on the Grand Ole Opry. It was a very, very cool moment.
Tell me about that job at Opryland, where my family actually used to vacation.
I graduated from high school, and my brother and I went and auditioned and got a job for the summer in a show there in a country music called Country Music USA. If you may remember it, it was a the show, I mean, when you're a kid, you just want to go ride the rides. But there were all the shows all around the park, and they had the one where it looked like a kind of a log cabin, had a big water wheel on the end of it. And that was kind of the big, you know, everybody remembers the water wheel turning and the water kind of fall.
Yeah.
And it was the stage. It was called the, now I can't remember the name of the stage. Anyway, they had the Country Music USA show, and we'd dress up like the country stars, you know, of the day, and come out and, you know, do your chorus of a song, and then run back and, you know, change clothes and come out and do another one. And I remember one of the things they would really preach to us, which I really consider it a major gift, that's kind of where I started my professional career, because you did three shows a day, sometimes four, and they were short, you know, 50 minute kind of shows, but they would preach and preach at us, because the tendency was to start, you know, goofing off with each other and, you know, getting inside jokes going and stuff, because you just bored them, you know, after you're doing the same thing, you know, four times a day, and you do it day after day after day. And they would say, look, the people that bought the ticket to the 400th show that you do this paid the same money as a piece of people did for the first show. So you need to give them the same performance. That's what a professional does. You give them the same performance. You know, you make sure this is about them. And don't forget that, you know. And that was really, honestly, as simple as it is, that was some great advice, because I thought, you know what, that's true. That's right. And so I've always had, honestly, I think as a result of that, my bands and different guys would probably tell you that I never had a very high tolerance for, like, inside goofing off on stage between band guys or whatever. You know, I've been to shows where you feel like, at a point, you almost feel like, and these guys, they've kind of forgot we're out here. They're having a great time among themselves. Yeah. But yeah. Remember, we're the audience, you know, that came to see you, you know. Not very often, but I know I've been in those shows. So anyway, all of that sort of plays in, I think, too, for me, the fact that, you know, wanting to remember I'm here, first of all, because these people have made it possible for me to be here tonight, not just the people at the first five shows when it was still fresh and new, but, you know, the 50th show or whatever, number one. Number two, the audience, if I'm aware of that, the audience is what is unique each night, and their stories and the way they engage and encounter the songs and the music. Probably the hardest time to do that would have been in the day when I was in the really big places with, you know, the arenas with lights to the point where I couldn't really even see anything other than just bright lights in my face, and it's kind of that deal. I think more now when the concerts are a little more intimate, I can see more of the people's faces, and I see the history that these songs have with them, and I see the tears, and I see the smiles, and I see the, oh man, you know, I remember that, you know, again, almost without words exchanged, I can almost see them going back to, you know, summer, you know, family trip, you know, saddling up their horses and the minivan going across country. You know, you've heard enough of those stories that you imagine, you know, this is connecting in that way. And I think all of that, you know, is part of what helps keep it from, you know, feeling like, yeah, I'm just doing the thing. Yeah, there are nights that I'll drift off and, you know, I'm thinking about got to take care of this or got to do that or what's going on. But I think, you know, that's part of the deal. It's just being able to kind of, okay, tonight this is a unique happening. This has never happened before. These particular people, this assembly of people with these songs with me. So this is a, you know, a special night. Try to keep that in mind.
Congratulations on 37 years of marriage with Mary Beth. How'd you meet her?
Met my wife, Mary Beth, in college in Anderson, Indiana, at Anderson College, now Anderson University. Went to my mailbox, and there was mail in there for Mary Beth Chapman. That was unusual because up to that point, it had always been my brother, Herbie, and I would share a mailbox. They put two students to one mailbox, and I was like, well, this is weird. You know, what happened? And a freshman had come in and alphabetically came between, you know, myself and my brother, Herbie. And so they assigned us to the mailbox together. Turns out that this Mary Beth Chapman was a very lovely young lady that I would meet and fall madly in love with and ask to share a mailbox with me forever. 37 years ago, this past October, we celebrated our 37th wedding anniversary. And so that's how we met. Yeah.
Was what's the secret, Stephen? 37 years.
I've got your number, and I will text you or call you as soon as I get it, as soon as I figure it out, sir. I promise I will let you know. I will not keep it a secret if I figure out what the secret is. Right now, my wife and I both would say the secret is to just keep showing up. We, listen, people that know us, and you know us a little bit, and I've tried to be very, very honest over the years, and my wife and I both have, and in what we've written, what we've talked about, what we've said, even what I've said from stage. We are two works in process still, even after 37 years. We're still by God's grace, and I don't say that lightly. I say it is His grace alone. We are still on the journey together, and I'm so thankful for that. We really are. We're two very determined, very stubborn people and fierce, you know, in terms of just, look, we know even with all the mess that we are and all the things that we're still, even after all these years, trying to figure out, we just keep showing up saying, you know what, this is what we want to finish this journey together. I mean, I wrote the song, I Will Be Here. People hear that. I remember when I first recorded that song and my producer, a guy named Phil Nash, who produced my first several records, he said, boy, I bet this song's going to be sung at a lot of weddings. And I remember being really stunned by that idea. And I said, Phil, I don't hear this being a wedding song. Tomorrow morning, if you wake up and the sun does not appear, I'll be here. If in the dark we lose sight of love, I'll be here. You want to sing that on your wedding day? You know, if it's dark and we don't even love each other anymore or don't feel like it, and when all that, I'm going to be here. It's like, no, at weddings you sing endless love. You know, you sing these, you know, songs. And he said, no, I don't know. Because for me, that song came from a lot of pain. and what would be the first of many, many years of counseling and meeting with our pastor and tears and just, God, we want to do this well, but we're just two broken people with a bunch of baggage, you know, that we didn't know when we came into this thing. And that song was written actually out of my parents' divorce, you know, mom and dad, who I told you, you know, there's this incredible transformation and God came and worked in our family for all these years. And so all of a sudden my parents split up and I'm going, wait a minute, this was the foundation. This is just how it works. You know, they had it figured out. God put God in the center and man, everything just falls in place. That was one of my first real, you know, lessons of, wait a minute, maybe it doesn't work that way after all. Maybe there's still a lot of brokenness, even when you've committed it all to the Lord. And I wrote that song out of that for Mary Beth. Like, I want to finish this race with you, even when it feels like, I don't know how we're going to do this. You know, I don't know how it'd be so easy to just go, okay, maybe this was not a good idea. You know, people have heard that song over the years and even say, gosh, just wish we had a marriage, you know, like you guys. That's so, it sounds so wonderful. And I'm like, listen to the words of that song. And, you know, I'm saying, hey, when it's really, really hard, I want to keep showing up and keep pursuing you and loving you. And it really is the grace of God, and just keep showing them. And honestly, I mean, I would try to put it maybe a little more spiritual, you know, sounding than that. But the scripture that I go to over and over again that I think is, if there is a secret, and I've said this, you know, I think so many of the books on the shelves and all of that, there's good stuff in a lot of them, but really they could probably all be boiled down to write it on one page, and it is, bear with one another in love. Love bears all things. Love believes all things. Love hopes all things, and love bears all things. I think it's saying, scripture is telling us, you're broken. You're going to be broken. The greatest thing you're going to have to just keep doing is loving each other, bearing with that brokenness, knowing that we're not going to be, it's not going to be right until heaven. It's not going to be all healed and all made right. So we're going to keep having to trust God for the strength and the grace that we need to keep loving each other. And I mean, say all that, it sounds like I'm sitting over here going, man, people are already going, wow, you're kind of bumming me out. You know, it's like, where's the joy? Where's the fun? You and Mary Beth look like you have such a great time. We really have. I mean, we've had amazing, incredible moments, you know, but it's been the great adventure. I mean, it's been mountains beyond anything we ever could have imagined. And it's been dark, dark, dark valleys too. And God has been faithful. And my best friend is Mary Beth Chapman on every step of the journey.
When we all desire to win the battles we no end is in sight. So we,
my guest is Stephen Curtis Chapman. Talk to me about the first time another artist records your song.
Well, I mentioned earlier, one of the first groups I saw growing up was the Imperials. I went and saw the Imperials in concert. And if you know anything about the Imperials, you know, back in the day, they were more of a gospel, southern, almost a four-part kind of quartet group, who toured with Elvis Presley and you know, did all that, kind of the Jordanaires, and the Imperials were two of his sort of background singers back in the day. So I saw them, they kind of began to get really cool and hip. A guy named Michael Omardian produced a big record for them, several big records. Russ Taff came along, started singing with them, and they got really cool and moved, you know, arguably they moved Christian music a lot, you know, towards a much cooler kind of thing, and took that sort of gospel. They were one of the ones, I think, that helped sort of take the gospel quartet sound and kind of transform it into a really cool thing. Real influential on me as a kid, those Omardian records with Russ Taff singing. And I had gone to Nashville and gotten a publishing deal. Bill Gaither heard some of my songs and gave me my first publishing deal. And I was going to school in Anderson and writing songs and spending my summer in Nashville working at Opryland. We mentioned, you know, I had my first summer job there in music, performing and then writing songs during the day. And I remember getting a call, your song's been put on hold by the Imperials. And I was like, you've got to be kidding me. You know, that's like, that would be one of the coolest things in the world. But it's on hold, probably not going to happen. And I was in college. I remember I was in my dorm. I came in my dorm, I'd been in class or been somewhere, and I came in and my brother had answered the phone and said, hey, they're cutting that song. They're cutting your you know, they're going to cut, the Imperials are going to cut Built to Last. And so we were off to the races, man. That was my first cut. I think the next cut after that was White Heart. cut a song of mine that I wrote with them called Vital Signs.
Check Your Vital Signs is your song?
Yeah, yeah.
Check your vital signs. Are they looking fine? What's your vital signs? You can keep yourself in line.
1987. What a year for music. U2, Joshua Tree, Guns N' Roses, Appetite for Destruction, George Michael, Faith, Michael Jackson, Bad, Springsteen, Tunnel of Love, Def Leppard, Hysteria, Stephen Curtis Chapman, First Hand, in the middle of some iconic music. There's your first record.
Yeah. Wow. That's crazy. Those were all 87. That is crazy. Wow. I did not know some of those. I mean, I remember listening to the Springsteen Tunnel of Love record in the studio when we were making my first record, and the guys were, you know, referencing some of that, some of those songs and some of the sounds, you know, like they always do in the studio. Well, hey, check this out. Let's get that drum sound or whatever, you know.
I'm going to hand you album covers.
Okay.
Of yours.
Yeah, all right.
Real Life record. Conversations.
Real Life Conversations. The mullet was strong at that point. And this record, you know, was the record that had my first, I mean, this was my second record. First record was First Hand, came out in 87. And then this was my second, His Eyes was my first number one song. My first number one at radio.
Sometimes his eyes were gentle and filled with laughter. And sometimes they cried. Sometimes there was a fire of holy anger in Jesus' eyes.
Yeah. Was that a tough pace to keep up album year after year?
At that point, you know, I was so excited and had so much energy. And just, man, the songs are like, you mean I get to go back in the studio and make another record? Heck yeah, I'll do that. Let's go next week, you know. Now, figuring out touring and, you know, all of that, there was certainly a lot. I did a lot of writing on airplanes and, you know, as I'm writing, you know, around the country. So I don't remember it being like, oh, man. It's time to make another record. I mean, I just remember being really excited, you know, about getting to record another, go in the studio, make more music. More to This Life, this record, obviously, a lot of people go back to this as sort of like, okay, that was the record when I began to take notice of, you know, this kid, you know, singer-songwriter guy, Stephen Curtis Chapman, because this is a record that had I Will Be Here on it. Arguably, for a lot of people, is one of my most known songs, sung in a lot of weddings, as I mentioned earlier. And More to This Life, just the song itself, is a very, really special song for me. My parents had gone through their divorce, and I was wrestling with a lot of that, so this record makes me think a lot about that. Songs like Waiting for Lightning, I wrote for my mom. A lot of the songs in here were songs just coming out of that, sort of the wrestling of all of that.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
For the sake of the call.
There it is. We will abandon it all. Yeah, this record was written from a lot of reading. I think I've sort of discovered somewhere along in here books. I mean, I read them because I had to when I was a kid. I just never, you know, books were kind of like a thing you did because you had to. And I started reading just some classics. I had a pastor at the time that would be like, I would encourage you to read, you know, read these books. And I remember somewhere in the process of that, I read a book by Dietrich Bonhoeffer called The Cost of Discipleship.
Oh, yeah.
And this, you know, was a heavy, heavy book, and I had to chew my way through it, but it had great, some just great things, and I remember just my heart kind of being opened, and I read a book called Loving God by Chuck Colson, that I would eventually get to know Chuck and have a great relationship with him. This record, the song For the Sake of the Call, came from a quote from that book from Dietrich Bonhoeffer. He made that statement about, you know, the disciples, you know, who followed Jesus for no other reason than for the sake of the call. And I just thought that was, you know, kind of light, you know, lights going off, bells and, you know, ringing. I was like, I got to write that song. That is a song. And so this record really was a lot about discipleship for me. Just what does it mean to really call myself a Christian, a follower of Jesus? And a lot of the songs that were inspired kind of from that.
Have we hit success yet?
Well, it's starting to click. It's starting to feel like there's some momentum there. You know, each of the records, I think this one had maybe a couple of songs, I know For the Sake of the Call. So it's starting to, yeah, it's starting to climb and you know, getting a feeling that, yeah, there's a lot going on. But it was for sure the next record that a lot of people would say, okay, that's when it sort of, you know, really took off.
Which is?
The Great Adventure.
I came in late to your catalog.
Okay.
I started working here in 09. I took the 90s off in Christian music. I grew up in it, so White Heart clicks. But I got rebellious, worked in mainstream radio.
Yeah,
so
I
missed your heyday.
Yeah.
So in 09 and 2010, when you and I would start doing these little radio interviews and whatnot, and then I came and saw you, I'm telling you, in 2010, 2011, it hit something in my heart that you wrote back in 92.
Yeah.
And I love the 25th anniversary version of it as well.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
So
was
good.
Yeah, that was really fun to get to do that. We did do a live video of this record. In fact, this is when Garth Brooks, you know, was blowing up and you know, taking the world by storm. He had this big show and big production. And I saw, you know, him, you know, running around on stage with a headset mic. And I was like, wait a minute. You can do that. I don't have to stand in one spot with a microphone. You know, I want to do that. You know, I want to be able to run around and go crazy. And so I got the headset mic, you know, and started doing that deal. Where is the hope? Where is the peace that will make this life complete? Forever man, woman, boy, and girl, looking for heaven in the real world.
1994. Heaven in the Real World.
What I remember about that, particularly, that was the record that I really began to work closely with Prison Fellowship and with Chuck Colson.
Hmm.
And I had written this song, Heaven in the Real World, and wanted to kind of change things up production-wise a little bit, too. So I went to L.A. and got to work with a guy that had worked on those Imperials records that I was mentioning with Michael Omardian, and it was a name. I was always a credit reader as a kid, you know, reading the credits on albums.
Oh, yeah.
And a guy named Bill Schnee, S-C-H-N-E-E. I never knew how to pronounce it when I was a kid. Like, is that Schnee, or how do you say that? But I remember reading his name on records like Toto, you know, four. I mean, the big records, Chicago records.
Yeah.
Huey Lewis in the News. He produced one of their records and was an engineer on all these, like, iconic records. But I had heard he was a Christian, and I knew he had this iconic studio in L.A. And Dan Huff, who was an amazing guitar player, original member of White Heart, who then went on to become one of the biggest guitar players in L.A., and then moved back to Nashville and is now one of the, you know, top producers of a lot of newer country music. He put together kind of an all-star tracking band. And I went out and I recorded with guys like Leland Sklar, who played bass on with James Taylor,
Phil Collins.
Yeah, he's the big beard, long beard guy, iconic bass player guy, played bass on this record. Drums, a guy named John Robinson, who played drums on Michael, you mentioned Michael Jackson's Beat It. He was the drummer on that. I mean, he's just a legend of a drummer. he was the drummer on the sessions, Dan Huff playing guitar, this band of all-stars, and went out to Los Angeles, to Hollywood, and made a record. You know, it was very, very cool, very exciting for me. And so that was what I remember about that record.
1999, Speechless.
Yeah, this was a change. This record, I worked with a new producer. First record I did with Brown Bannister. Love Brown, had mad respect for him, and he had, of course, has made so many iconic records. So I worked with a new producer. I used a lot of my band guys, and honestly, there's a guy named Adam Anders. When I think of that record, think of Adam Anders, who was a bass player, came to play bass for me. He was 19 years old, just a phenom, just one of these kind of wonder kids. You go like, all right, this guy's on another level. He played bass with me, started writing songs, was kind of doing a little bit, dabbling in everything, production and all of that. And he was the guy who came up with a lot of the beats and the sounds, because I thought, I'm going to start to explore using some of the drum loops and all of that, which is Dive, you know, a lot of the songs on this record that had some infused, some stuff that I hadn't really used that much of before that. Adam would go on to write a song for the Backstreet Boys. They would record and ended up, you know, he played bass and helped produce this record, and then would go on to move to LA and start working in the, you know, in the mainstream music business, and would eventually, I turned on the television one night and there's Adam Anders on Tonight Show talking with Jay Leno at the time, I think it was before Fallon, and it was Jay Leno talking. I was like, that's Adam, that's my buddy, that's my boy. And they're talking to him because he's creating all of the music for this hit TV show Glee. And it turns out he did all of the music for that entire show and went on to just be a megastar. So that's, I think about that. He's still a buddy. He's still a good friend. Married Nikki Hassman, who was in the original Avalon, if you remember the short little blonde girl. And she and he got married, and they've gone on to write a bunch of music for High School Musical and all this kind of stuff. But so that Adam was involved in that record. Yeah, that was obviously a big record. Had a bunch of, you know, songs that went to number one on radio, and there was a lot of great memories with that record.
All right, Stephen, we're going to jump ahead to 2012. Tell me about your Joy Christmas album.
You know, this was after we lost Maria, and, you know, a time when it was like, I don't know if I'll make more music. Will I make another record? You know, what will that feel like, look like? Because obviously life got very, very heavy, and thinking of music for a season, there's just the idea. I mean, I made a record called Beauty Will Rise in that time, which was just me pouring out the pain and the laments of losing our daughter. This was a record that came a few years after that, and I think the fact that I could make a record called Joy was no small miracle in and of itself. And so there's a lot to this record in particular, because I felt like it was really me beginning to say, you know what, this is particularly why Christmas matters so much, because God with us. I knew that. I knew it in experience, but I knew it since I was a kid, you know, and celebrated the fact that, yeah, God's with us in the hard things and the good things, but nothing at this, you know, close to this depth of just feeling desperate for, you know, for hope, and desperate for knowing that God is with me, with my family. We had experienced that. And so this record was, I think, important for me in that sense, that I felt like, hey, I want to sing about joy. They both can exist in my life. I am going to laugh again. We are going to have good memories as a family, and we are going to be able to, you know, hang Maria's stocking at Christmas, and we're going to cry, and we're going to feel, you know, we're going to ache and long for the day when this is all made right. You know, when this is all, when the broken heart is made whole. We believe that day's coming, but we can still, we can laugh and feel joy now too. So that was, that was a big deal to be able to make that record.
Love, take these words that I'm speaking. Love, take these thoughts that I'm thinking. Love, take me over. Love, fill up all of my space. And love, stand right here in my place. Love, hear this prayer that I'm praying. Love, take me over. Love, take me over.
This was, for me, you know, the glorious unfolding, you know, as the song says, and as this whole album really says, is that, you know what? We are on a journey, and we're in a story. God is telling a story with our lives, if we can really believe it and trust it, that even in the chapters that are unbearable and seem like we're not going to make it, I have been around long enough now by God's grace. I've been able to say that the story's not over yet. And there is, even in this, God is, as he promised, working all of these things together. We don't see it yet. We see bits and pieces of it. We'll get little glimpses. By faith, we keep holding on, keep showing up, like I said, and believing. You know, there's a song called Together, you know, where I talk about Mary Beth's and my journey together, you know, that we've been through dark, dark valleys, and we've been on mountaintops, but by God's grace, we are still together. And that's really the story of this record, is that, you know, God is telling a good story. He is good. He is faithful, even when life is, you know, is not good. So this is this record really is evidence of God's faithfulness more than anything I can imagine.
So I dance with Cinderella while she's here in my arms, 'cause I know.
You have a tattoo.
Yes. When Maria passed away, we all wanted to do something kind of to remember her and just carry that. Obviously, we're going to remember her every day in our hearts, but she had left a little drawing with us. She drew, it was kind of her signature flower that she drew all the time when she was as soon as she could learn to draw. She had this little thing. She would draw six-petal flower and had the little stem and you know, the leaves off of it. And it was just kind of her iconic picture. You'd find them all around the house. And the day that she passed away, the day she went to be with Jesus, she had drawn a flower that morning, and it was sitting on her little art table where she would sit and draw and cut and paste and glue and tape things together. And she loved just a craft. She loved making crafts. She wrote the word see on that picture that day. And we had never seen her write that word. She had just turned 5. She was just learning how to write her letters, and she was writing. She could write mom. She could write dad. She had learned how to write her name, Maria, and she had learned the words, I love you. And she could write. Those were the only words we had ever seen her write. So when we found this picture and her word, S-E-E-C, for us, that was a very, very powerful message that we felt like God had given her, you know, in her handwriting to say, see, keep seeing by faith, keep looking through this glass dark, you know, that the scripture talks about, and know that someday you're going to see what I'm seeing, because I'm seeing the face of Jesus. I'm seeing heaven, and it's real. So that word just carried enormous weight for us as a family. I went and had her flower tattooed on my arm, just like she drew it, and just like she colored it, and I had the word see tattooed. So yes, I have that right here on my shoulder.
Can you see that day vividly still? You were there.
Yeah, yeah.
You were there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All of us, except for Emily. Yeah, we're all at home the day of the accident, the day Maria went to be with Jesus. And you know what? It is, it is 13 years, and thankfully, and with some work and a lot of prayer, a lot of counseling, and still lots more, I'm sure, that's needed this side of heaven. I would say it like this. I think, you know, when we, I talk about, you know, when we gather as a family, when we, you know, at Christmas time, we hang Maria's stocking, you know, those first years, the firsts, you know, the first Christmas, the first birthday, the first anniversary of her going to heaven, those are unbearable. The second, the third, it's still so hard, but the memories, you know, in the beginning are so hard and painful that there's sweetness in them, but it's that bittersweet, but the bitter is so much more palatable than the sweetness. You know there are sweet memories and you see pictures, but it's like, it's just so hard. It's hard to even see that sweet face, because all you think about is what's broken and what's not as it should be. And so you tell the story, you sing the song, you say, but the story's not over yet. You know, the story's not over. She's with Jesus. He has promised but he's going to wipe every tear. That day's coming. That day's coming. We're going to keep holding on to it. And then, you know, the saying, you know, that time heals all things. Well, time doesn't heal anything, but healing does come with time. And I think as time passes, what we're able to do is remember and have the sweetness, the bitterness, and the pain does, there's like a, it dies down, the intensity of that becomes a little less and allows room for more of the joy and more of the sweet memories. So we can have those. And it's still that, you know, that ache is there, but we can remember Maria and we can tell the stories and we can talk and we can laugh and say, man, she would always say, I love it when my whole family is together. That's for whatever reason, that when we would all come together and all the kids were home, and, you know, because the boys were still at home, but Emily, it was, you know, in college when Maria passed and was getting ready to get married, had gotten engaged, and the boys were off, you know, doing their thing. And whenever we all got to be together, she would say, I love it when my whole family is together. We would say that, say, remember when Maria would say that, you know, and it was like, ugh, it was like a knife through your heart every time you said it and tears in your eyes. Now we can say that and smile and go, gosh, that was, we're going to be together again. And we know that, you know, and so we can remember that, if that makes any sense, you know. So it's like you begin to take those steps, you know, for us in those first years, I think it was so hard to even feel like if we move forward, are we somehow going to leave our memories behind? And that's one of the things about grief that's just so weird, you know, is that you don't know how to do it. Nobody, everybody's different and everything is different. And, you know, it's like, can we go forward? Because we're never going to want to forget, and we're never going to forget. But how can we process this in a way that it's not just so excruciating and painful? And can I sing songs like The Great Adventure and Dive and feel the joy and all of that? And can those exist together, the pain and the ache and the joy? And I think that's what healing looks like, where, yeah, those can exist together. And so we can, you know, still remember that awful day, and yet we can bear it because of the days, there have been good days since, and there have been good memories, and there's been new. I think a lot of it is the new, too. God, you know, we get grandbabies, and we get to make new memories. They don't replace those old ones. They just make those old, really hard things more bearable. Because God's making all things new. He keeps making all things new. And just as much as we believe that, you know, he's made Maria new and she's living her best life truly, and that's not just words that we stick a Band-Aid on a gaping wound. It's like, that's our hope. That is the gospel. As Paul says, if our hope is only for this life, to try to get it figured out here, try to get a good life here, it's like, man, you're missing the point. That's you're to be pitied, is the words that he uses. You know, that's a pitiful way to live, to just think, hey, my faith is just for this life. Because there is a promise of all being well, all, you know, the sad things coming untrue, like they say in Lord of the Rings, you know, all the sad things will come untrue. But in the meantime, you know, here, God is making all things new too, and he's given us new stories to tell and new songs to sing and new podcasts to do with Corey Mann. For crying out loud. Come on, that's good stuff.
Not that there's an empty tank of gas. You're a very sprite, however old you are these days.
59, Corey.
What's left to do? I know you're not done, but yeah. Do you have a, you know what, I'd like to fill in the blank.
Man, I want to write a movie soundtrack. In fact, I'm in conversations with some guys who have a film in the works that want me to do that. And so I've started working on some music for that. That would be a really cool thing. I love movies. I'm moved, you know, by those and the music and the way that interacts with it is a fascinating thing to me.
But best movie soundtrack, go.
Amistad.
I was love not it. Ready for you to say that.
I know. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, John Williams, you know, yes. He's crazy.
Yes.
I would like to write a musical. I've dabbled with the idea and the thought, you know, of taking maybe my songs and taking them. And I love the way some of these movies and some of these musicals have been made in recent years, where they'll take the songs of an artist and kind of weave a story around that.
Elton John comes to mind, Rocket Man.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Fascinating, you know, just the way that story was told of his life and using music in that way. So that's something that I would love, I've talked about and would love to do. I have been writing some songs. I've got a batch of new songs, and I didn't know if I would make another record. I don't even know if you make records anymore because everything has changed so much. Right. Honestly, about it, I just feel like, you know, I talk with my boys a lot, you know, Caleb and Will and Colony House is about, you know, they're like, Dad, we love records. We love making records, but it's such an uphill battle because people just make songs now and they release songs to, you know, stream. And so the idea of a record that takes you on a journey and tells a story and has, you know, the do people care anymore? You know, we care, and there are some of us out there, you know, that still do, but as a whole, so then you kind of got to fight that and go, I don't know, do I do this, try to, is what's relevant with how you even make music now? So there's a lot that I'm wrestling with, to be honest with you, about just the way I've done this all these years and the way, you know, old dogs, new tricks, you know, all that kind of stuff. But I got some things in my heart that I want to say, and I feel like I'm a big, big fan growing up of, not a non-fan, but I wasn't on the Bruce Springsteen train. I mean, we talk about Tunnel of Love, and I know I listened to that record, and we would reference different things, but I wasn't ever just like, oh, man, Springsteen is the boss, he's the man, you know, I knew the hits kind of thing. But in recent years, I have become a huge fan because here's a guy at 70 years old making records like, I mean, he made a record called Western Stars that is a masterpiece.
Beautiful.
You know that record?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man, come on. Letters to You, what a record. But here's a guy who's saying, you know, I heard him say this somewhere in an interview, and he said, I've had conversations with people, you know, music is those are my conversations, and I've been having this conversation with people for a lot of years, and I love sitting down and just talking and having this conversation. So I want to keep doing it as long as people will listen and tell me what they're thinking. I want to keep talking about it. I want to keep telling them, you know, having these conversations. That's a beautiful thing. And I think the things that he's saying now are things that he could only say as a 70-year-old guy,
right? Because
he's reflective, he's looking back, he's thinking differently. He's not as, you know, he's not as going to go, you know, wave his flags and, you know, and be as political or whatever. Maybe it's just like, man, this is just life. This is what I'm feeling now, and I feel that way. I feel like there's some things that I can say now at 59 that I wouldn't have said at 49 or 39 or in these other CDs, and it doesn't. It's just more things that I feel like I'd love to be able to share. So I'm going to make a record. I want to make some new music this next year at 35 years. But I'm also, it's empty nest years with Mary Beth and my bride and my best friend. And I want to enjoy those years with her.
You're tooling down a dirt road in your truck and you see a hitchhiker. You decide to give him a ride. They've got no idea who you are.
Yeah.
And the conversation does come up. You're a songwriter. You're a singer.
Yeah.
What do you choose to play them if they go, let me hear you?
Wow.
What would you choose?
That's good. That's a great way to ask that question because I've been asked a lot of different versions of that. Your favorite song, if you could only sing one song. That one I would probably The Great Adventure. I'd probably say, you know, this kind of the scope of the whole thing. This tells the story. And I can tell you more. It's been more of an adventure than I even knew when I wrote this song because I was still a pretty young, you know, young buck. I've been on the journey for quite a while now, but none of it's not true. It's all true. It's just probably a whole lot deeper than I even knew when I was singing this song. But this will tell you a little bit about who I am.
Saddle up your horses.
Personally, this has been a bucket list, and it's been great getting to know you, and thank you for a few moments together. This has been great.
Yeah, thank you, Corey.
Saddle up your horses, we got a trail to play. Throughout the yonder, God's amazing grace. Let's follow our leader into the glorious unknown. This is a life.
What Else with Corey Mann from the Studio DNA Podcast Network. Hit the follow or subscribe button so you never miss an episode on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or Google Play. Original music by Jason Roy. Feel free to leave some feedback, write a review, or tell a friend about What Else with Corey Mann on the Studio DNA Podcast Network.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Get all the Masterforce outdoor power equipment you need to maintain your yard at Menards. Own the outdoors with Masterforce 80-volt power equipment, delivering all the power of gas without the maintenance. The entire 80-volt line is powered by brushless motors for ultimate performance and productivity. From lawnmowers to leaf blowers, string trimmers, and more, find everything you need to create the lawn of your dreams with Masterforce power equipment at Menards.
Save big money at Menards.